Good morning and welcome back to Nach Yami. Today we're going to be learning together Direi Hayamim Beis Perek Chav Ches, the 28th chapter of the second book of Direi Hayamim. This is a rather jarring perek, so just be aware of that as we enter it, especially contrasting it to the previous perek where we learned about Yotam, who was one of the most pristine and innocent and law-abiding kings of Israel. We now enter the reign of Ahaz. Ahaz, his son, is everything which is the opposite of that. Our perek is 27 psukim long, and the parallel parasha can be found in Melachim Beis, perek Yud Tes Zion, the 16th chapter of Melachim Beis. It is also the events are to be commented on by Yeshayahu Navi in perek Zion as well. We first hear about in the first four psukim the evil of Ahaz. What does that mean? So we're told that at year 20 is when he takes the throne, and he also rules for 16 years like his father did, and he did not do what was good in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're given examples of what he does. In fact, he goes in the ways of the kings of Israel. He makes these idol worship shrines, he serves Baal, he sacrifices in Geber in Ben Hinnom, in this valley outside Jerusalem, and he brings his children through the fire to Molech, like all the practices of the nations before him, and he brings incense and sacrifices on all the hills and under every tree. I mean, this is an unbelievable change from the previous generation. What's fascinating is the Mepharshim don't explain why. We, in the 21st century, like to explain why. We like to explain why people tick and why people do what they do, and psychologically in their childhood, we like to explain these things. The Mepharshim understand that people have free choice. And this person is exercising, Ahaz is exercising his free choice. And even though his father was a great, great tzaddik, and his son is going to be a great tzaddik, he himself made bad decisions, very bad decisions. And the Mepharshim don't question it. This is what actually happened. We now hear about the response to that. So we hear that Hashem gives him in the hands of the king of Aram, and he is also given in the hands of, and many of his people are taken into captivity, and in the hands of Israel, the king of Israel. So this is Ritzin, the king of Aram, and this is and we also hear about the king of Israel this time is Pekach ben Remaliahu. So these are the two kings, and they are both hurting Yehuda greatly. So we hear that Pekach ben Remaliahu, in fact, kills 120,000 soldiers, Bnei Chayil, of the south. And he, in fact, kills prominent people like Zichri, the Gibor Ephraim, Maasei Yahu, the king Ben HaMelech, and Azrikam, the Negid Abayas. We hear Elkanam, the Mishnah, all these people are killed. Terrible events that are going on over here. And in fact, 200,000 women and children are taken captive to Israel, to Shomron, under the hands of Israel. So just this is an unbelievably sad moment in time, a civil war and as well. Why are they attacking Yehuda right now? So the truth is, in fact, if you look at the actual chain of events, the Malbim points this out, if you compare Melachim, Direi Hayamim, and Yeshayahu all together, the events go as follows. First, there is the individual attacks on Jerusalem by the kingdom of the north, Pekach ben Remaliahu, and by Ritzin, the king of Aram, individually. They take many captives, as is described in these psukim, but they do not successfully manage to break the siege of Jerusalem. And later on, they're going to join together in an alliance against Jerusalem, which will ultimately cause Ahaz to solicit the help of Assyria in the further north. That's the sort of timeline of things. Why is it they are attacking right now? So the Da'at Mikra points out a very important point, and that is from their perspective, they are attacking because they are terrified of the kingdom of the empire of the north, Assyria. And so therefore, Pekach ben Remaliahu and Ritzin have made this alliance, the Armenian-Israelite alliance, to fight against the Assyrians. However, Ahaz is sitting on the hedge. He does not want to take a side against the Assyrians. And because he refuses to throw his lot in, he is being attacked because of refusing to join the coalition. That's in terms of the geopolitics of it. The psukim here explain that may be what the nations are thinking, but ultimately, Vayidnehu Hashem Elokav Biyad Melech Aram. It's because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants this to happen as a punishment that this is what happens. Now, in the middle of this whole thing, while all these captives are taken to the area of Shomron, a remarkable incident occurs. A Navi of Hashem, his name is Oded, comes up and he makes a presentation to Israel, and he says, look, He says, Hashem, the God of your fathers, you gave the people of Yehuda in your hands, but you killed them bezaf, in anger. Adla shamayim yigia, the cries reached heavens. But now, you know what? You're taking them into captivity, la'avodim v'lishvachos, to servants and slave women, is going to bring only more guilt on you. Listen to me and return them to their brothers and sisters, because the charon of Hashem will burn against you. The anger of Hashem will burn against you. And that's what ends up happening. So the heads of the groups turn to the people and say, let's release them. We do not want to add guilt to our portfolio. And that's what they do. They all just abandon these captives right there. However, a number of regal people, a number of leaders, do take them and they clothe the refugees, and they put shoes on them, and they give them food and water and drink, and they bring them on those who can't walk on donkeys, and they bring them to Yerichai, the city of date palms, by their brothers and sisters, and they returned to Shomron. So just understand the arguments that's being made over here. The way it works, so what Oded is trying to convey to the people of the north, to the Israelites, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did need to punish Yehuda because of their actions, because of what Ahaz brought into the land. However, that having said that, he gave them in the hands of the Israelites because he thought the Israelites would use their free will to be merciful on their brethren. But yet they did not. They were extremely cruel. And now you've done what you deserved, says the Malbim, in explaining Oded's words. You've done what they deserve. They deserve to be punished, and they were punished. So now, if you go further and you keep them as captives, you're going beyond what it is that they deserve, and it'll be added to the many, many levels of guilt already on your name. And therefore, don't do that, and they agree. That's what ends up happening. That is the conversation that's happening over here. What is interesting is they take them to Yericho, to Jericho. Why to Jericho? So Mitzvah points out that there were people of Yehuda living in Jericho at this time. So he's bringing these 200,000 people who are back to their to those who are going to rehabilitate them. The Malbim points out that it may be that this is in contrast to the first group. The first group of people just abandon them and run away, and that essentially leaves them to fend for themselves, whereas the second group of noblemen takes them and takes them under their wings, and perhaps even if they're settling in Jericho, even if Jericho isn't only a city of Judeans, it is giving them foster homes in order to be able to recalibrate themselves as well. We now hear about a further attack from the north. At this point in time, we hear about how Ahaz now solicits the help of Ashur of Assyria. The king of Assyria is Tiglath-Pileser III, and it sends off a great bribe to bring him in. But at the same time, we hear about the attack of the Edomites in the southeast, in the Plishtim, in the southwest, and we hear about the different cities which are conquered by all these different nations which are attacking and cities which are ceded to all these nations. And we're told that ultimately Tiglath-Pileser comes in and he does save them, but Vayotzar loy v'loy chazaka, he doesn't really give the strength to Ahaz in the south, and ultimately he has to make great sacrifices to Assyria. So why does he try Assyria? So the Malbim makes it very clear in Yeshayahu Perek Zion that Yeshayahu turned to Ahaz and told him, don't be afraid of the alliance of Ritzin and Pekach. Rather, stay steadfast, daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He refused to, and that's why he called Assyria. He didn't trust Hashem. He believed that he needed an ally. So he ultimately brings in Assyria, which is a terrible thing. He's bringing in Assyria against his own brethren, and ultimately it's going to wipe him out. Does it actually happen? Yes. In fact, Assyria, once he's welcomed in and bribed in, does destroy Aram. And in fact, this is the beginning of the galus, of the exile, the 10 tribes of the north, upon the invitation. When Assyria is walked, Tiglath-Pileser begins the first of the many tours down where he starts exiling the Israelites in the north as well. Why is it that he's not end up helping them? So the Malbim points out that yes, it's true that he fought off these kingdoms in the north, but then afterwards Ahaz had to pay great taxes to Assyria, and Assyria did not help him against the other battles in the southeast and the southwest, as are being described in his Pesukim. So he was abandoned now, penniless, against the other enemies as the kingdom starts falling apart, all because of his sins. But you'd think at this point in time maybe he's going to fix himself, but no, alas, not. We hear now from Psukim Chof Beis to Chof Hei, as that even though Be'es Heitzar Loi, at the time Hashem sent him many tzaras, many difficulties, by Yosef Lim'ol Ba'Hashem, he still continued to rebuke go against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we hear about how he sacrifices to the gods of Damascus, and he says that maybe that I'll sacrifice the gods of Aram, even though those are the ones that tricked or misled the nation of Israel. And he did all, he actually took off the bases of the wash basins and the doors of the temple, and he sent them off to Assyria and set up bamos and all kinds of altars to sacrifice to Elohim Achirim, to other gods, in all the cities of Yehuda. Really terrible. So not only is he not learning from his tzaras, but he's continuing to do worse from this as well. It's important to add the parasha in Sefer Melachim in over here, where unfortunately actually there's an extra detail that Ahaz takes a trip up to Damascus and he visits the kingdom of Assyria, and he's so taken by their sacrifice there that he sends a kohen up to go and measure the Mizbech, the altar in Damascus, and he brings him and makes a new altar. It's Uriah HaKohen who sends up to reconstruct a Mizbech in the Beis HaMikdash. He pushes the altar aside in order to facilitate this new altar, which is matching and reflecting the altar in Damascus. And he brings his korbanos on it, and the Mizbeach of Hashem is sidelined. A terrible, terrible thing which is going on over here. It seems that this really is idol worship in the Beis HaMikdash itself, whether it be dualism or polytheism. It is a terrible thing. Why is he vandalizing the Mikdash? So it could be, as Rashi says, because to make space, he needs to clear space for this new Mizbeach. Or it could be because he needs to actually pay more money to keep bribing Assyria to be on their good side. It's also worthwhile noting that all of these concessions, and this they will call it the religious concessions, might be trying to inculturate Judea as a geopolitical assurance and insurance that maybe he'll be protected by the Assyrians if, in fact, he has the same value system and same culture, which ultimately doesn't work. But maybe it's the it's not so much that he is religiously ideological over here, but he is practically ideological. He wants to save himself. And finally, we hear the last two psukim, how with the rest of his books are written in the annals of the Malchi Yehuda and Yisrael. And when he dies, he is buried in Yerushalayim, but not in the kever of the Malchi Yisrael, of the graves of the kings of Judea. And in fact, the Mishnah in Psachim at the end of the fourth parak describes how Chizkiyahu in fact brought his body to rest on a bed of ropes. So it was to demonstrate how much he disapproved of his father's actions, because Chizkiyahu is his son. Are there any saving graces about the kingdom of Ahaz? The answer is no. The Gemara Megillah Daf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph tells us Hu berish oy mitchilosoy v'ad soifoy. He was bad from beginning to end. So why wasn't he punished in the same way? The Mefarshim explained, because he was wedged between two great tzaddikim, Yotam and Chizkiyahu, which is why he did not get the same treatment as later kings who were really bad as well. In fact, the Midrash Tanchuma says that he stopped bringing the Korban Tamid in the Beis HaMikdash based on these psukim. There was a cessation of natural sacrifice the daily sacrifice which had been taking place from the times of Moshe Rabbeinu till now. A really terrible, terrible time, but there is going to be some degree of resolution as you read the next few psukim and the next few prakim. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.